Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. We're joined today by two editors of the new book, Voices of Resistance, Diaries of Genocide, James Harker and Basma Galiini, which features the work of four Gaza-based writers, including Batul Abu Akhlin, who also joins us. Batul is a 20-year-old Palestinian poet and translator born and raised in Gaza City. She's a student of English literature and translation at the Islamic University of Gaza. At the age of 15, she won the Pargil Poetry Prize for her poem, I Did Not Steal the Cloud, which was also translated and published as part of the anthology Di Acqua e di Tempo. Her poem, I Want a Grave, was published in Penguin's Letters from Gaza, published earlier this year. She was the 2024 Poet in Residence with Modern Poetry and Translation, for whom she collected and translated Seashells, an anthology of emerging poets from Gaza. Her poem, Gunpowder, was among the winners of the London Magazine Poetry Prize of 2025. Batul's debut bilingual poetry collection, 48 Kilograms, was published by Tenement Press in June 2025, and extracts from her diaries have been performed by Leila Herandi at the Belgrade Theatre in Coventry. Writing about the imminent publication of her new poetry collection, Batul Abu Akhlin is overcome by guilt. I've written all my poems on the blood of my comrades and loved ones, she writes. On my pain, on my burnt fingertips, on the prospect of my own death. When I finish writing a poem, I look at it with tears welling in my eyes and heart. Oh God, how beautiful it is, and how ashamed I am. That pain looks so beautiful. And this is how the book starts. Batul, I want to start with you. You're in Gaza. We're recording this on August 11th as Israel is carrying out full-scale slaughter in northern Gaza and Gaza City. Describe, if you can, what's happening around you. Batul, are you there?
Yes.
There you are.
Sorry, Nora, but can you repeat the question?
Yeah, just if you can describe for us what's happening around you. And oh, and I want to tell our audience that There's little electricity or no electricity right now, and so Batul's camera is off because it's dark anyway. So Batul, yes, please describe what's happening around you. We're recording on August 11th. There's a full-scale slaughter happening in northern Gaza. Describe for us what it's like.
First of all, thank you for having me today. And, well, the situation here got a little bit better, especially when it comes to food. They started to allow entering food and aids to Gaza. And it sounds really ridiculous because we go basically to the market and buy aids, which we receive for free. And we're happy that there's food, which is, like we say, that the price has dropped to less than a half, which is actually, like, this half is, like, 20 times more expensive than the usual days. So basically, we're just happy that we can find something to eat that we can almost barely buy. So, yeah. I got from the market 10 minutes ago, so I was basically there. It's so lovely just to see people in the street and they're buying food and sugar, especially sugar. So basically you can find four things, mainly flour, oil, sugar, and feta cheese. So we're happy just to have all those kind of things, as like it's been ages since we had feta cheese. So yeah, it sounds wonderful. And I'm living near the sea, so basically all the edge trucks comes from my street. So this is the daily view from my window. I just watch people sitting on the edge trucks and holding flower bags, or they're on their way team or boosted bands.
Batul, you're a poet and a writer. What's your process in writing these days? I mean, these days are full of it must be just completely absurd, you know, like going to the market and trying to find food. Gaza was once this very self-sustained place, and Israel and the West has turned it into, what people are saying is like unrecognizable, and the absurdities of this collective punishment, this 22 months of genocide, forced starvation, the bombing of every single hospital, complete disruption of any normal life that was already, made completely abnormal by almost two decades of siege, 80 years of settler colonization. What is your process in writing? How do you, what is your inspiration? What are you writing about these days?
I just got my diaries, which I've been writing since the beginning of genocide. So, yes, and I decided to just become, let's say, a full-time writer. So this is what I'm doing. I go to a workplace near to my house because of the electricity, and I need to work on my laptop. So I go to a workspace. Recently, I started to do that from 9 a.m. or 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And I sit and keep writing. So, yeah, I decided to drop the whole semester in university and just to take it easy more and just to do what I love. So I decided just to keep writing my diaries and to collect them, because if I didn't do that, I won't forget, but I'm not sure if I'll survive till the end of the genocide. And I would like to start doing that. So I'm writing my diaries, basically.
Batul, if you have it nearby, is there anything that you would like to read for us, either that has been published in Voices of Resistance or something that you're working on currently?
Well, diaries, or
yeah, whatever, whichever you want to share with us.
I didn't really prepare myself for that. So if you give me just 2 minutes to
absolutely
to go through my files.
Great. Great. Well, let's turn to James and Basma. Basma, you grew up in Gaza. You're in the UK now. Can you tell us about this project and what, for you, what it's been like working with these young writers and, all the while seeing everything you've known and loved in Gaza be attacked and, in this, I mean, just incomprehensible genocide?
First of all, thank you for having us. Thank you, Electronic Intifada, for having us and giving us the platform to speak here, and especially Batul, obviously. Since the beginning of the genocide, well, I'll go back before the genocide. In 2014, Comma Press started, asked out of Abu Sayyaf, a Palestinian writer, to document to write his diaries. And ever since then, we thought it would be the only thing you can do on any level. You know, you feel so helpless when those onslaughts take place. I mean, what can a publishing house, maybe your first reactions, what can a publishing house do in an emergency situation like this, when people lives are at stake and Palestinians are being murdered by the Israeli army on a daily basis? But then you realize that the equivalent of an emergency state for short stories and fiction is writing diaries, and that's what we did. We asked Atif Abu Sayyaf to write his diaries at the beginning of the genocide, and he documented his diaries in Don't Look Left, A Diary of Genocide. And then we reached out to Batul, Sundus, Nahil and Ala, who we to write their diaries. And for me, there is a hugely personal element, obviously, because in 2023, I took my family, my partner, Ra, and my two children. I took them in 2022, we went to Gaza to visit my mother, and we spent a month there. And Ra, the chief editor of Comma Press, met a lot of Palestinian writers who he'd been in touch with beforehand, and including Nahil and Sundus. So when the genocide happened the following year, in 2023, it just felt very important that we document or ask those who can to write some diaries, especially there were some connections with Rifat al-Arair, who was a friend of ours, and some of the writers in the book are his students. So it was, for me personally, I'm going to be honest with you, I just feel you go through phases of thinking, what is the point? What is the point of any of it? But then you read the diaries and you meet Batul and you meet Sundus and you realize, and Nahil, and you speak to them and you realize that's the point. We need to instill hope and determination, resilience, and especially resistance in any way and form possible. And in this particular instance, writing is the way to resist. That's where I'm personally coming from it. So, yeah.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, there's ways in which art and writing and narrative, I mean, this is what Dr. Rifat always talked about too, which is like, you know, we have to find ways to punch through the despair, you know, the walls of hopelessness or helplessness that the West, you know, and Israel as the perpetrator of this genocide want us to to feel. We want, you know, they want us to feel helpless.
They're depending on despair. They are absolutely depending on it. Yeah.
That's it. Batul, if you're ready, we would love to hear some of your writing. She might be.
You're on mute, Batul. You're on mute.
Oh, there we go.
Yes, I'm here. Great. I'm gonna read a poem.
Great.
Not a diary. So it's Gunpowder, the one which won third place of the London Magazine Poetry Prize. Gunpowder. The city is just a bride. She went to a salon without asking about it before. They said, "Don't worry, we'll make you look perfect for your wedding. Give me gunpowder, please. Let's cover some lives here and there on her face. No need for lipstick. Your lips now are covered with crimson blood. No need for highlighter. The gunpowder's firelight streak across your cheekbones. No need for eyeshadow. We burned the elder trees that were grown over your eyelids. Such a perfect shade. No need to fake tears for leaving your parents' house. We demolished it. Stuffed it inside a small box. This is your wedding gift, they said. When she started to cry, they told her, drink this, it will make you feel much better. She was fool enough to drink. Since then, her womb bloomed only with martyrs.
It's beautiful. Thank you. And just, yeah, James Harker, you're also an editor. Can you talk about what it's like, you know, collecting these kinds of writings, these poems, these diary entries, working with people like Batul, and what this project has meant for you personally?
Thank you. Yes, I think if it was any other situation in which I was working as an editor with Batul and with Sun Doesn't Heal, Allah, it would be such an honor to work with writers as brilliant as they are, because I think there's so much depth in these diaries and so much poetry, actually, so much humor. For example, Batul, in your diary where you speak about the about catching the trying to catch the taxi, and I think with every writer it's been a different process. I know Batul, your diaries are focused on 1 week, which is the week of the ceasefire announcement back on January 16th, and but with Sun Doesn't Heal, it was about collecting diaries over a period of you know, 18 months. And originally some of those were written for a stage version of this project. Yes, but really it is an honor to work with these, but I think it's just so important that you know, not just this book, but that all your voice, your words, continue to be heard in so many places.
Yeah, Batul, I mean, can you talk about that a little bit? About why, you know, I mean, the section that James was just referring to of your diary entries that are, you know, I think they start a few days before the ceasefire in January, and you kind of like, you know, you talk about being able to take a breath, but with a very kind of like tense feeling, of course, and we all know that, you know, Israel broke the ceasefire just you know, 6-7 weeks after, and since has just enacted, you know, again, the worst crimes of humanity that that anyone has ever seen. Can you talk about those diary entries that you wrote, and kind of the, you know, the scope of focus on yourself? You know, you're asking yourself these very you know, deep kind of emotional questions about who you are, what kind of a writer you are, you know, yourself as a woman, and you write to someone named Shem. Can you talk a little bit about what's in this book, and those bits of writings that you wanted to include?
Actually, until the last moment, I was just thinking of just emailing Comma Press and telling them I don't want to publish those diaries. I really questioned myself so much, multiple times, if I really don't want to show this or not. They mean so much to me. They are so personal. I'm talking more not only about the world around me, but also how I feel towards it and how I interact with everything and how most of the time I was just depressed and tired and depressed enough to stay lying in bed all the time. So it wasn't really easy for me just to share this part about how tired I was, how weak I was, or this is how I used to think about it. And especially the part about me being a woman in such situations and how hard it is to be just by yourself and the oldest daughter, and you hold all the responsibility almost of the whole family over my head. So it wasn't really easy to share those diaries. And by the way, I still suffer till today with the transports. Like, I got back to home while I'm walking, actually, because I couldn't find a car. So I still suffer with that till today. And this diaries, I talked also about how it feels like being a writer in such occasions and how it feels like to edit others, not only to be edited. And I'm still having the same questions. And I was actually going through my previous diaries, the one which wasn't published with Comma Press and the ones also after that. And I do really still have the same questions and I can't find an answer for them. I'm not sure if I'll be able to find answers one day, but I'm looking for some. This is how it's been. And by the way, Shams is the name of the notebook in which I used to write my diaries. I love to name everything around me, including my notebooks. So all of them have names and one of them was Shams. So till the moment I have, I guess, 6 notebooks. And I just published 7 in Voices of Resistance because my diaries include also sometimes drafts of poems, sometimes just some thoughts and ideas about things I noticed while just sitting and holding this notebook and watching the world around me. And yeah, just enjoying the beauty in the midst of the genocide, watching the sky, the sunset, the sunrise, the birds, the sea also. So yeah, it those notebooks were a bit messy. So I felt 7 will be enough till I have more time and till I decide just to collect all those ideas together.
Basma, can you tell us about some of the other writers included in this collection, and you know how you found them, how it was editing, you know, with James and with Ra, their work, and kind of what stands out for you the most in this collection?
Well, the way the editorial process worked, for lack of a better term, was there was loads of different. There were 3 of us, and we were all talking to different writers within the collection. Now, James, you can fill in any gaps here, but I can confidently speak about Nahil, Sundus, and Ala Batul. I read her diaries and for the first time, and I have to say that I was in complete awe of her writing. It was unbelievable how I was reading it and thinking, this is no one would struggle to, as unrelatable as the situation Gaza is, no one will struggle to relate to those emotions and the way she describes her, just how she's feeling on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis is just so, I don't think I've ever, I mean, I'm 42 and I don't think I've ever been that in touch with the way I feel on any level, let alone being able to express it. Just the way she speaks about her feelings and reflects on the world is unbelievable. And that completely struck me. Though Betul has been in touch with James throughout the editorial process. I met Nahil and Sundus. We've lost Betul there. I met Nahil and Sundus and in Gaza when we went in 2022 as part of just when we went, we were there for a month and we wanted to make it a point to just meet as many writers as we possibly could. Because like I said, Ra had previously worked with writers, but he'd never met them. He'd been publishing books from Gaza for a long time. Comma had been publishing books from Gaza for a long time. So it was just part of it being full circle in a sense for him and Comma. So when we were there in 2022, we met Nahil. We actually met her or found out about her through one of our other editors, Maya Abul Hayat, who edited the Book of Ramallah. And she came to my mum's flat and showed us her work and we had coffee. And then Sundus was one of Rifat's students. And Rifat, for 3 days, had taken Ra, shown him around Gaza, fed him, got him to meet as many people as possible. And Sundus was one of the people he met. Ala, we met through Atif, who published his diaries with us as well. That's how we met them. And yeah, that was your question, wasn't it?
Yes. And what kind of stood out to you the most? Like,
They all stood out
selection. Yeah.
In different ways. They all do things differently. So Nahil is very, very funny. Generally speaking, Gazans have this gallows sense of humor. We're very dark. We joke about, and you can imagine what it's like being for me being surrounded by English people and then joking about something and everyone just kind of complete silence in the room, no one knowing what to do or say with that. I mean, James can relate to that, I guess. But Nahil is very good at writing about at showing that kind of dark humor. Ala's writing is about her experience, you know, with childbirth, and they all had different elements to contribute. And like I said, with Betul, it's amazing the way she describes her feelings. And it was different things for different writers. They just all came together perfectly. I think James could speak also more about this because he had an overarching kind of view, a bit, you know, more objective maybe on the process and the writing and the editorial. I don't know, but that's my take on it.
Yeah, James, for you, like, what stood out to you? I mean, you're a playwright, you know, there's so much storytelling that is involved in playwriting, obviously, and you know, in these diaries, in these, you know, in these poems, in these very emotive and very personal narratives that are kind of woven through voices of resistance. What stood out for you?
Yes, I think a lot of playwriting is about editing down to have such a short amount of time to say something. And there was so much that the writers of these diaries included. I think Nahil wrote almost every day, and there is a longer ebook version of this book, but it's still less than was written. But I agree with Bessel about Nahil's sort of very dark humor, and there's a great story she includes about all the times that she feels that she's escaped death, and then one of the closest times she comes is when in another family that are having a completely different argument, one of them throws a pressure cooker and it almost hits her in the head, and that would have been the moment of her martyrdom, she says. And I think for Sundas, it's she's very, writes very tenderly and beautifully, but also with a real sense of the ironies of the occupation. There's a little bit, if you're happy for me to read it, that Sundas wrote, that I think is,
I would love that, yeah,
says a lot. It's in this section where she's talking about the murder of her nieces and nephews. It's called We Kill Terrorism. She wrote, "Of course, they don't intend to kill us. Even when they drop 2,000 pound bombs on us, even when they rain down bombardments across entire neighborhoods and make life impossible in our city. No, don't misunderstand. They are merely eradicating terrorism. 2 days ago, terrorism was hiding in the body of Omar, my six-year-old nephew, perhaps in his heart, or maybe among his soft locks of hair. So they killed him. They dropped two missiles on him and his siblings, Aya and Ahmed, and his niece, Sila, who was only 7 months old, killing them all. Who knows? Perhaps terrorism hides in the warmth of a home, in the bells of churches or the minarets of mosques, between the pages in the books, at the streets and alleyways of the camps, or amidst the tents of the displaced. The Israeli occupation has every right to erase anything from the face of the earth if they so desire. And no one has the right to criticize Israel. After all, they are saving humanity from the evildoers. How valiant of them. How noble." So that section of the book just always stops me in my tracks reading it.
Yeah. 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 The real economy of the language there. That's remarkable. Tell us a little bit more about Sundas. And Basma, you said that she was a student of Rifat. Can you talk about how, you know, his legacy continues to echo throughout all of his students and his students' students now? How do you see the ongoing kind of teachings of Dr. Rifat in his students and in this writing collection?
I mean, you only need to read, for example, Sundas' writing to see. I have no idea how to answer that question. I have no idea. I'll have to think about that, because to be honest, it was Ra who dealt more with Rifat. It was Ra, he was Ra's friend. I mean, feel free to edit all this out, obviously. I'm just saying, he was Ra's friend. I met him once. We had coffee. We had coffee for we were in Il Baqa restaurant, which was bombed recently. And he just showed up in this really tiny car, and he had, I think, a copy of Roots that he was reading. And he's just, there was just something so beautiful about him. It just sounds so. And I hadn't, it was Rahu who was in touch with him. But for me, just, I really wish I'd known him before that, after I met him, that we had coffee for 45 minutes. And it was just, he was just such a nice, relaxing presence. In terms of literature, I've gotten to know him through his literature with everybody else after he was killed. And whenever I see his name or meet someone that he taught, you get loads of people saying, or kids or children, or to me, kids, that, you know, loads of young people saying, he taught me Ahmed Mhannas, who's been present in a lot of the stage readings of Voices of Resistance, is one of his students. And it's just lovely to see people who he knew. But in terms of literature, I can't think of his poems, his kite poem, for example, the way it just spread you know, it's just very powerful. But I can't, don't really know how to answer that question.
It's kind of like his influence was kind of immeasurable.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just the way you just think of his presence before. I mean, people knew who he was before he was killed by the Israelis, and then after he was killed, just you cannot believe the amount of people he touched, whose lives he touched, and it's just amazing.
Batul, we're hopefully you're able to connect again. Maybe just one more question and then I'll let you go so that you don't have to keep trying to connect, and especially with the lack of internet and electricity there. But Batul, what do you hope readers get out of this collection, and your writing in particular? How do you want people to interpret or absorb your writing? Oh, we're having a hard time connecting. Batul, can you hear us?
Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, keep going.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you hear us? Oh, yeah, it's always so hard to maintain a stable connection with our colleagues in Gaza. Batul, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, James, why don't you take that question? Like, what has the impact been already? I mean, the book was just recently published in the UK. You've had these public stage readings of some of the work from this book. How can you kind of assess the impact that it is making, and what have the writers said about what they hope comes out of this?
It's a shame that we can't hear from Batul on this, and also from Batul on Rifat and his influence on her, because I feel like she's the person here who's really in depth on Rifat and his poetry and the, I know we've had conversations about the roots of the If I Must Die poem and everyone seeing a different direction. I know Ra saw Claude McKay and the Black Panthers, and I saw Emily Dickinson, and there's Rupert Brooke, and the richness of all of that. And I think that Batul's writing is also so full of that richness of drawing on history and being completely unique. But sorry, I was hoping that would buy time for Batul to pop back up and be able to answer that, but she's unfortunately gone. I think it amazes me that there are people here who aren't aware of some of the things that are being written about in this book and aren't aware of exactly what Israel are doing in this genocide. And I think certainly when we've had stage readings, you know, like we've had challenges from UK Lawyers for Israel and other groups, but when people come to see it, and especially people who maybe they've been brought along by a partner or somebody, and they have to sit down and listen and hear these words without being able to look away, I think it can have a profound impact on people. And I really hope that there's a reach to this beyond people like us, you know, and that perhaps the perspective and the relatability of, say, Batul's work, just the way she talks about her life, is a way to connect to different people and to give them an understanding of the nature of the oppression, but also the richness of the humanity that all the writers capture different facets of. So I hope that's there. It's certainly there in the amazing text that the writers provided. And I hope, even though this book is just a snapshot of that in many ways, I hope that's something that comes across to people.
I love that. And yeah, it looks like we might still have Batul with us. Batul, are you there? Let's see if we can unmute her mic. Hi, can you hear us? Oh, maybe. Batul, are you there?
Yeah.
It's a weak connection, but it's there. Batul, if you can talk about the impact that Dr. Rifat had on your writing and what you hope people get, come away with after reading your words, after reading and hearing the stories that you and the other writers in this collection have put down on paper.
So basically through my writing, I'm just trying to show the readers what's happening really inside me, what's happening ahead, and how I see things around me. I mostly cover through the smallest details, which most of the people won't notice. So I love to write about these small details, and I try to them to the readers. So basically, this is what I'm trying to show. Just my head and my eyes and my senses, and which is basically journalists one show. And I guess even social media, when you show boost or when you show people react, you see their faces, you see their tears and everything, but you don't see what's happening inside. So I'm trying just to tell about the inside and a little bit about the outside through my eyes. The impact of Dr. Rifat Al-Arir, well, it's a quite a really not a long story, but basically I keep telling people that he taught me, because it's kind of, I don't want to keep describing how Dr. Rifat Al-Arir and what he really means for me. On the 7th of October, when this genocide started, I was in my way to Dr. Rifat Al-Arir's office, and I was just going to introduce myself to him after being shy for almost a year and saying, like, what if he booked me? What if he said this and that? And yeah, I decided to be courage and to go to introduce myself to him. And he was almost the only person I could find in my university who wouldn't mind if I told him I'm just crying because the sun today is really beautiful, and he will totally understand what I mean, because he was a real poet. So I was just feeling so lonely in university. I couldn't find anyone who can understand really all these small details. And then I found about Dr. Rifat Al-Arir and about his recorded lectures, and I just kept devouring them until I took the courage to go. But it didn't happen. And then there was an interview on the BBC. There was Masab Abu Tuha and Dr. Rifat Al-Arir, and I joined them. And during that, I was like, oh my God, I didn't expect myself to be talking to him on the BBC about the genocide, just like that. And then suddenly we received some warnings about the building next to us is going to be bombed, and we had suddenly to leave the place. And I was just saying, guys, I have to leave. They are going to bomb the place next to us. And it was really chaotic. And since that time, I kept feeling, why was you shy that much? You missed a lot. So, and I was just, there is a poem in my book which is called How I Cook My Grief. And it was written since before the genocide. So I was going to discuss the translation of this poem with him, but unfortunately this didn't happen. And until I received the news of his murder, and it was the best thing. And I kept just asking myself, what's the purpose of writing? He kept writing and he kept telling the truth, but all of this didn't protect him. And this doesn't even protect anyone. It just puts us more in danger. They are afraid of words, of people who are just have loud voice and they tell things. So yeah, sometimes I just think a lot about what I do, about my writing, about even my like being with you now and talking about all these things. I know I'm putting maybe myself in danger and my family, and even Basma, James, and Ra, and Comma Press, and everyone that published my writing, all of them are just putting themselves in danger, and I feel I'm taking part of putting people in danger. So, yeah, that's just horrible, basically. I feel I turned into another missile that might explode and harm people around me.
I mean, I think that's a normal, natural concern and worry, because Israel has tried to turn words into weapons. I mean, they assassinated Rifat and so many others, because, you know, there were, because he was a courageous voice. But I think that, you know, by documenting, by writing, by continuing to, you know, to put down on paper what you're seeing around you and what you're going through, I think is, I mean, it's an act of resistance. It's an act of courage. It's an act of dignity. And to keep going is the only thing I think that we can do. You know, in the UK, where James and Basma and your co-editor Ra are, they're trying to make it illegal to say that you don't support the genocide, that you want Israel to stop killing children. You know, they're afraid of words. They're afraid of public opinion, which is swinging, you know, every day more and more against this Holocaust that we're seeing. I don't know. I mean, James and Basma, how do you hold that? I mean, obviously it is frightening for people in Gaza to be public, to write about what they're seeing, to report on what they're seeing. I mean, we saw Anas Asharif, you know, one of the most prominent broadcast journalists working for Al Jazeera Arabic throughout the 22 months of this genocide, who was hunted by the Israeli military openly and publicly. He was just killed last night. How do you hold this? How do we console those, you know, around us who are still working and writing poems? And I mean, what do we tell, you know, our colleagues like Batul? How important is it to keep writing these days?
What do you reckon, James? Do you want this or do you want me to start? And you can,
it's kind of a rhetorical question, you know, like, but what is it that, that we can say at this point?
Oh, I've personally given up. I've said this a few times now. I've given up on any kind of news outlets or any source of news. You just, to say the least, take it with a pinch of salt. I don't trust it. I don't trust the intention of any kind of news reporting. You know, with the whole manufacturing consent, there's always a reason why news is being reported the way it has. Recently, the news is being reported in a way to make us think certain things, so then we can serve a certain purpose unknowingly. So I've lost hope in any of that. I've lost hope in you know, objective journalism. There's no such thing at the moment, and I think that's why we have turned to diaries and short stories and fiction, because if there is any hope for anyone in the world to know what really is going on in Gaza, I think it's the we've got a big responsibility on our hands to somehow relay that and provide the space for Gazan writers to say what they want to say, describe their lives the way they want to describe them, instead of other people doing it for them in the form of lies and, you know, just messed up curations of what they think the world should see about them. That's all. I find myself being really angry. Like, if say I'm reading Betul's writing, I'm angry at the fact that I'm surprised by certain things that she writes, let's say, because I was an 18, 20-year-old once in Gaza. I know how I felt, and I find a lot of her writing relatable. Obviously, it's a lot more heightened, the emotions at the moment, because of the genocide, but people want to other us. The world wants to other us. You know, it's complicated. It's just, you know, just don't even try. So it's very powerful what Betul is doing and what Sundus is doing. It's very powerful. And Betul says something. She said something to the effect of, she, and correct me if I'm wrong, Betul, she hates it when people just, or she, when she describes her writing as beautiful, obviously, because it's painful, but it's not meant to be beautiful. It's meant to be powerful. It's meant to tell people what's really going on, and it's meant to take control of the description and take control of the narrative and take it in our own hands. Gazans, we can speak for ourselves. We can tell people what's happening. We don't need people telling us what to say or how to think or what to do. We're very capable. So that's why it's very important for the writers to keep writing, the singers to keep singing, and the cooks to keep cooking, you know? And so we can take control of our lives and our narratives.
Yeah, absolutely. In the full dignity that that you deserve. Yeah, James, anything to add on that? How do we measure the importance of that kind of writing, of not speaking for a group, especially Palestinians who have been so thoroughly dehumanized by the West, and especially, you know, Western corporate media, to, you know, to create this kind of platform, where they can narrate their own experience.
I mean, there's not much I can add to what Basma has said. I think there is a breaking point of the absurdity of the Israeli narrative in the West. And, you know, to the point you hear Israeli politicians saying, I know, I think, you know, and what was it last weekend? 470 people arrested in London for saying, holding signs saying I oppose genocide, I support Palestine action. I think in some ways this the absurdity that pushes people who were otherwise disconnected to seek out, I guess, the words of Gazans, of Palestinians, but then you know, the price of what it's taken to bring that is not, I don't know. Yeah, there's nothing eloquent I can add to that, except to say, yeah, no, sorry. Sorry, that was an eloquent answer. And what Basma said was everything. I'm more interested to hear what Batul thinks as well about, if she's got thoughts on that, on readers here specifically.
Yeah, Batul, I mean, you know, the writing is all in English. It's for an English-speaking audience. What kind of impact, you know, do you hope that this collection creates?
I would like to say something. We're not writing about dignity or the dignity we still have. We're writing about the dignity we threw in the garbage when the first day of the genocide came. When we stand for the face, when we stand it for the first time and drinking water lines, when we stand it for the first time to get AIDS, and when we had to beg people to give us what we never expected to ask for. We had to leave our homes and just to live in tents or in shelter in the most humiliating ways. When I had to share the bathroom with 30 people, mostly strangers, people I never met in my life, and I had no privacy. I just go to the bathroom and people are waiting for me while I... This is what I'm writing about, and this is what the other writers also trying to say. I mean, we lost our dignity, or we decided just to neglect its existence, otherwise we wasn't going to be able to continue. Because thinking about dignity and about our lives as humans, it will drive us crazy if we did that. I mean, even let me talk about my father, who lost his job and suddenly her, like our two apartments and everything, and he found him just after 50 years without anything at all. And he had to try in all possible ways just to save his family and to keep everything up and to feed us and to take care with everything. So yeah, this is what we're writing about. It's not about our dignity. We lost it months ago. Let's say it's been years actually. So this is what we're writing about.
I think that's an incredibly powerful place to end today. And Batul Abu Akhlin, you are one of the four writers whose collections of writing appear in the new book, Voices of Resistance, Diaries of Genocide. We'll have a link to the book on the blog post that accompanies this episode of the Electronic Intifada podcast. James and Basma, where can people find the book? And if there's any, you know, if people want to hold dramatic readings, you know, stage readings of some of the work, how can they get in touch with Comma Press?
Okay, I'll answer, and James, you can add stuff if I've missed anything. The book is available on our Comma Press website, commapress.co.uk. It's on Amazon. It's on the ebook will be available this week as well. It's available in some bookshops, but mainly on our website and on Amazon, you'll find it. And if you want to hold readings, you can get in touch with us at Comma Am I right, James? Just email us at comma.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You'll and find the details on the website. Sorry.
Sorry, Basma. And I think that's encouraged, isn't it? If people want to, I think, and obviously all of the money from the book goes to the writers directly. Also in North America, Biblioasis are publishing it. And I think it's available to pre-order now as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can get in touch with us if you do any readings, and then we could just share, you know, the press. We can promote the readings, and yeah.
I love that. Thank you all so much, Batul Abouakleen, James Harker, and Basma Gallini at Comma Press.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you all for the work that you're all doing. Batul, please, please, please be as safe as you can, of course. And thank you all for making the time to come and talk about the book on the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.